Okay, so this is Natasha Taschuk interviewing Colonel Bob Peacock on 30th October 2007 in the basement of the University of Victoria McPherson Library. So Bob, I'm going to highlight two of the main objectives of the research today. So we're going to be looking to illuminate Canada's role in NATO during the period of 1951 into the early 80s with reference to 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade Group. And then secondly, we're going to try to highlight Canada's weapons procurements in West Germany during this period and attempt to determine what contribution Canada could have made to stopping Soviet aggression. So on with the basics. When and where were you born?
Walkerville, Ontario, 1929.
Okay. Were either of your parents employed by the military?
No.
What made you join the military?
Well, I decided that early on in during World War II, and I decided that I wished to, being a student of history, I wished to be part of the organization, and I tried all the examinations for the military college, got an entry, and survived 4 years to get commissioned. Yeah.
Wonderful. And into what branch of the service then did you join?
Oh, I chose infantry.
Infantry?
Yeah.
Okay. So, where were you stationed first with the 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade Group, or was it then 1st Canadian Infantry?
It, first, before 4 CMBG was in Europe, it was 4 CIBG, which Infantry Brigade Group, and before that was 2nd Brigade, which I served with between 1955 and late 57, and before that was 27th Brigade, who set up a Canadian contribution in Hanover. We moved in, they had moved down to Zost Hangar. So I went there in 55, the fall of 55, with 1st Battalion Princess Patricia's, mm-hmm. and went to a little camp called Camp Zwoll in Dalinghofen outside Hamer, where I've spent an awful lot of time. And I trained there for 2 years, came home, went back under 4 CMBG in 1963. I served there from 63 to 69 in 4 CMBG with a two years in the center. I was seconded to the British Army and headquarters 2nd British Division as Deputy Assistant Quartermaster General for Operations, which was bringing APCs, armored
personnel
stuff in, and taking care of emergency deployment of stocks and petrol, oils, lubricants, ammunition, defense stores like barbed wire mines and stuff like that. And that was a valuable 2 years. Then I commanded 2nd Battalion and Mechanized Battalion Battle Group in 67 to 69, and then came home.
So you did it, you had a total of 3 tours in Germany,
yeah,
right?
And then I had 8 years with the brigade, mm-hmm. or in the operation sense, I had 2 more years in the 1970s. I was with the Mutual Balanced Force Reduction Conference in Vienna as military, Canadian military advisor. We had our own little ambassadorial group that negotiated with the Warsaw Pact, with all the other NATO partners. And so that was a fascinating period. A very hot time from about 1949 to well on into the coming down of the Berlin Wall. There's never a dull moment. And so
that sounds like quite an extensive career you've had.
Mm.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about weapon systems and procurement with 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade Group. So first, what kind of weapons were you provided with in 4 CMBG? Now that's a broad question, I know, but you can make of it what you'd like.
When we first went in 55, we were still using basically World War II weapons. The gunners had 25-pounder guns, very light. We were using old model Centurion tanks, and as far as the infantry concerned, we had trucks or we had nothing. And we had bolt action rifles, Bren guns, Vickers machine guns. We did have 17 pounders. We had 3-inch mortars or 81 millimeter mortars. And it was just basically the same equipment that we had in Korea, and which was available in 1944, 45, Canadian Army. New equipment didn't start to come in until late 50s. And in 1963, we were motorized. We all had 3/4-ton trucks to move us quickly around the area. And then I was in charge of bringing the first group of armored personnel carriers in and reorganizing and retraining the unit. I was the operations officer at the time, and retraining the unit to handle mechanized warfare. And we continued that. And then I went up to the British and did the same thing with them, and came back down and commanded this mechanized battle group. A mechanized battle group is, at that time, 4 infantry rifle companies, completely mounted in APCs, with tow anti-tank weapons, recoilless rifles, lots of mortars, a very powerful organization. But on top of that, you had a troop of engineers, you had a squadron of tanks, and you had the direct support always of a battery of self-propelled 155 howitzers on tracks. So it was a very powerful thing. That went on until late 1968, when Mr. Trudeau started hacking away. It took us 20 years to build that force, plus the other forces in Canada, to an internationally agreed level of supremacy. And then it went down the tube.
Now, what sorts of training were provided for the use of the weapons that you just mentioned?
Oh, goodness, we trained all the time. They're mostly unit courses, but there were brigade courses, or there's courses at various schools on the introduction of weapons. And once the weapon was installed, then most of the training was done under a controlled system by the experts in the unit. And so, for example, during my youth, I was a mortar platoon officer, and we continued to train people on the mortars, even though they weren't attached to the mortar platoon, so that we had a backup of training throughout the unit. Plus, you could use that same training to handle not 81 millimeter, but 60 millimeter. And your problem was having people trained to match the weapon. Training is your business. If you're not training, you're not doing very much.
Good. So I know Canada as well had access to little drone rocket launchers.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Were nuclear weapons available to 4th Brigade Group? And if so, who was in control of them?
Oh, goodness, yes. There was Honest John. I wish I had my friend Denny Crow, who commanded the battery here. But this is, the Honest John. We trained with that in Wainwright prior to going over. I've seen it fired 2 or 3 times. It was an obsolete weapon the moment it was produced, because there are infinite number of other weapons were far better, but this is the one we had. Yes, there were nuclear weapons available, and they were within 20 minutes drive of our cantonment. The artillery and the patricias were in the same general area. We had the control was under Americans, but they would be delivered. We were in charge of security, and the brigade provided 1 infantry rifle company 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the platoon of that company was fully armed and handling security at this dump. storage place, and the other, the balance of the company was on 20 minutes notice to be there.
Wow. So nobody was getting by them?
No. This was, and this rotated between different battalions, the Van Duzium or the Royal Canadian Regiment, ourselves. And so there were 12 infantry companies. So every 12th week, your company got this 24/7 task. Yeah, and when I was with the British, we had a nuclear storage place with nuclear weapons in a place called Diepholz, just north of Bielefeld, toward Hanover, and that provided the backup for 1st British Division, 2nd British Division, and the Dutch. So, yes, they were available, and we trained in everything that we did. We trained under the threat of nuclear war, and which made most of us very cynical, because if you have even witnessed this in a movie, you realize that theory and practice, which, you know, the idea of the of trying to get men to move through this, there has to be another way. So the other way was mutual assured destruction, and neither side would use it. And the same thing happened with chemical warfare, and the same thing happened with bacteriological warfare, and psychological or psychodrugs.
Yeah,
those were, you know, they're humorous to look at in a movie, but the damage that's done. Yeah, we didn't use things like Agent Orange, though we did run into that in Vietnam. No, it was nuclear weapons were available.
Mm-hmm. Available and considered as a viable option.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
For sound tactical reasons, mm-hmm. namely, we were outnumbered about 4-1.
Yeah. Now, during your tours in Germany, did you notice any fluctuations in the emphasis that was placed upon conventional versus nuclear warfare?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when we first went there in the 50s, this was a for real possibility. For the simple reason, let me just backtrack. Mm-hmm. When we first went to Germany, the defense line was the Rhine. Now Germany came in back into the fold, and Germany said, that isn't good enough. So the line went forward to the Weser River. And as the Germans got more and more troops trained and units trained, our whole concept changed, and we moved back up to the East German border. So the area from Braunschweig down to the Fulda Gap and up to east of Hamburg became our forward line, our forward deployment line. And so you had the whole of Germany in which you're playing. On the other side, in the Soviet ground forces, Germany, you had 27 divisions, of which 7 were fully armored. And the rest were motorized rifle divisions, each with a regiment of armor. Add to that 50,000 Bundeswehrpolizei from the East German side, plus 7 or 8 German divisions, plus 5 Czech divisions, plus 22 of Poles, and so on and so. And we're sitting there with 7 divisions spread across northern Germany. Eventually got up to about 20 divisions. But nuclear weapons were the only way you're going to stop this. And the other side knew it. Now, they said they would use them too, but who knows? Yeah, but the threat had to be there because we didn't have anything else.
Yeah. And did you notice at any point, you know, the sort of up or down trend in terms of emphasis upon nuclear weapons?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This it gradually even off conventional versus nuclear, we were doing more and more conventional training throughout the 60s. If the nuclear thing was still there, but the weapons imbalance, the numbers imbalance such that we could defend ourselves, because you need about anywhere from a 3 to a 10 to 1 advantage to make a victory. And we were, and our equipment was improving, our modernization of equipment was improving, we had more aircraft than we'd had before, and they had the nuclear weapons. So what we really laughed and said, what we're practicing is mechanized guerrilla warfare. And battle groups going around, highly mobile, plugging holes and holding pieces of ground, knowing the Russian tactics and East German tactics. Through the 60s and into the 70s, it became more and more back to conventional. If that is any saner than nuclear warfare, I don't know.
I don't think anyone can judge that. How did the weapons available to 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade Group compare to those of other NATO members you may have observed?
They compared quite favorably. Now, the British introduced, went to a complete rearmament in the late 1950s, and by the time I was with them, they were getting the product of their development, and they had a whole new family of tanks, they had a whole new family of armored personnel carriers, and a whole new family of self-propelled artillery and what have you. So they were in pretty good shape, given the growing pains of any new weapon system. And there are a lot of, and the adjusting your logistics to cater to a whole new weapon system. For example, a Centurion tank, we'll get onto that probably with a Leopard. In winter weather, a Centurion tank would get 4 to 5 gallons per mile. The Leopard would get 2.5 miles per gallon. You see the difference. The imbalance of equipment as it came in 2nd Division, for example, we had 4 different types of helicopters. Each required different fuel. So, you have to rationalize these and then come back and say, all right, all these go over to one division, this goes over. So, to reduce your logistic overload. In the Canadian Brigade, our APCs were diesel. That was good. And with the APCs, we outran our Centurions all the time. So we were just delighted any time we could hook up with a German Panzer Battalion driving Leopard 1s, because then we could move at the same speed they could move. The other ways, hell, we could walk as fast as the Centurion. Don't let me knock the Centurion too much. It has a magnificent gunnery system, and magnificent. And it used to win the Canada Cup for armored proficiency in NATO year after year.
Did it
really? Yeah. They did very, very well.
But in terms of speed?
Oh, speed.
Very poor.
And the Centurion was a nightmare to maintain. It had 2 Rolls-Royce Merlins in the back, and to change that engine was a 24-hour job. Whereas a Leopard, you could change the engine in 40 minutes. So, and the same thing with our APCs. We could change an engine in the field with my unit mechanics and have it on the road in probably an hour if we had everything there. And the British with their 432 APC, that was a major workshop job. So, British have never been great at maintenance. If you've ever owned a British car, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's always awkward to do. And the Americans may not have as good a product, but they, and the Germans, maybe not as good a product, but you can sure maintain the hell of it. Now the Russians learned simplicity with the T-34 and all their equipment, and did very well with it.
Yeah, we're going to actually discuss some of the Soviet equipment a little later on as well. Now, this question is going to pertain, we're on to the subject of tanks now, so that's great. I know in 1976, Ottawa signed a contract to purchase new Leopards to replace the outdated Centurions. How, or what were the main ways that the Leopard sort of superseded the Centurion?
Two.
How was the Leopard better than the Centurion in the main ways?
Speed, cross-country, ability, maintenance, economy of fuel, crew comfort. It had an extremely good gunnery system, which the Germans took from the British, which was fine. And by the way, the Canadian Leopards were upgraded with a new gunnery system. The vehicles hasn't changed, but the gunnery system has just made it added 10, 15 years to its service life. It's like updating ships out here. You update the gubbins. You don't need to update the chassis. It was a delight. It was a delight to work with the Leopard Mark I. The crews loved it. They found it extremely easy to maintain. I was trained in the Royal Canadian Army Corps School on Shermans and then on Centurion, Mark I and Mark II. And I'll tell you, there's just no comparison. It's the Centurion is the end of World War II technology. The Leopard is the beginning of the German thinking as a result of their experience on the Russian front. They knew what they were going to face, and they designed a vehicle to do it. And the Leopard 2 is infinitely superior. Both are probably not technically as efficient as the Abrams or some of the other big new American tanks, but as a workmanlike piece of equipment, I'd take the Leopard over the Abrams anytime, because it's more economical. Not just that isn't, but it's got a nice low silhouette, excellent gunnery system, which is the only reason you have a tank, and I say just easily maintained, maintained in the field by the crew,
which is infinitely valuable.
But the Centurion had served extremely well.
Okay. Now, I read in a book, it was a history of the 4CMBG, that by 1954, the Centurion tanks were approaching the third quarter of their life expectancy for the engine. Did their replacement in 76 come far too late, or was it an appropriate time for them to be replaced?
Oh, no. When we first went to Germany, we were using the same gunnery system and the same vehicles, really, that were the same type that were used in Korea, 20-pounder guns. That was changed to 105-millimeter gun, which has later been upgraded to 120. So, you know, this vehicle, the engines were changed. And you just kept changing the engines over and rebuilding the engines until you got new tanks. And so, but expensive in fuel, expensive in hours of maintenance, expensive in... it was just an expensive tank to run.
Like you said, 24 hours to change the engine.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Now, someone will probably come and tell you that they did it in 6 hours. Well, okay, under absolutely ideal conditions with a mass of people working doing this. But if you've ever taken a British car apart, you know you can't get there from here. You've got to go down and take the whole thing out. And you can't do anything until you take the engine out. Whereas the Leopard, you can go down, take a component out, take another component out, and it can be done with nuts and bolts. And it's very simple.
That's wonderful. How did the Centurion compare to what other NATO members were using in West Germany? So that's a similar question to before, but specifically in West Germany. I mean, what the British were using with even the Dutch.
Oh, there's a mixed mash of equipment, and of course, other people's equipment is always better than your own. This is a fact with soldiers. They always look and say, that's better equipment than we have. Why don't we have that? But without checking what the faults are in that vehicle and what was the vehicle designed for. Now, we have different design requirements than, say, Germany, and the British have different than we do. So, the Dutch, they had good equipment, but it was usually one stage back of the British, and it was usually British or American, but if the Americans had the M62 tank, the Dutch were still running the M48, upgraded. Not a bad tank, don't get me wrong, it's just not the final. It's not the Cadillac here down in the Chevrolet. And the same thing in with the Canadian Brigade. We would look at the British APCs, which had better armor. And you could, and some of them had turrets on that you could put a 20 or 30 caliber cannon on it with a couple of machine guns. Those were called Saladins. We would look with envy in those because ours were very thin aluminum. Ours were battlefield taxis. They weren't to be fought out of. You were to get your troops through a lot of rifle fire and shrapnel and stuff like that. And once you got there, you dropped the ramp and people got out. Old joke in Vietnam with people who stayed in APCs. If you want to go to hell with your buddies, just stay in the APC. Because an RPG-7 will just destroy an APC. And that's, and as you get into urban warfare or close country warfare, the advantage of an armored vehicle drops dramatically because of the visibility. And tank hunting teams go in and pick them off. So, you win some, you lose some.
Do you have any comments on how the Canadian tanks compared with the Soviet Joseph Stalin's?
Oh, the Joseph Stalin's are a huge monster. That's not the one you were worried about.
Not the heavy tanks, no.
The tanks were the T-54, which was, that was the first one we ran into in the 50s, and that is the improved version, an improved model of the T-34, which literally won World War II. The next one came out very quickly, which made obsolete most of the armor that we had, was the T-62. The T-62 had a three-man crew, four-man crew. And you had a gunner, loader, you had a driver, and you had the crew commander. The Centurion had five. So, you know, you start looking at this. T-62, excellent cross-country capability in all weather, diesel. Not finished the way an American tank is, or a British tank is. You know, the rough edges are there, but it's a workmanlike piece of equipment. I had the opportunity to drive an early model of the T-62 called the T-59 when I was visiting a Chinese unit in Beijing. outside Beijing, and they just let me go and drive it. It's not for me, because I'm too big. But it's great for people who are about 5 foot five, and one of them has to be strong as an ox to move the ammunition and throw these big rounds into the... But the gunnery system was simpler than the Western system. And therefore, when the T-62s and the Western-based gunnery systems were matched up in the Israeli wars, the T-62s lost out all the time. And the same thing has happened with the T-72s. They are always... and the T-82 is supposed to be the very best. I've never seen one. But our technology and gunnery has improved in ammunition and in fire control system to a point where the Russians haven't been able to match it, and the Chinese haven't yet either. But there's still, they have a lot of them, and if one goes, the other one will get you.
Safety in numbers. Okay, let's move on and talk a little bit about weapons maintenance and utility. And this may not be precisely your area, but if we want to skip over the questions, that's fine. Well, I'll just go through them a little bit. What was the serviceability of Canada's main equipment and weapon systems? And we kind of went over that with the Centurion and the Leopard.
Our service and maintenance from the unit level on up into brigade was excellent. Spare parts were always a problem. Infantry armored personnel carriers in the mid to late 60s were off the road because of one part. It's called a quill shaft. That's a small thing about the size of an orange. And they cost about $75, from what I remember, in 1968. But it's one of those parts on any piece of equipment which goes. As a result, you would have anywhere from 30 to 60 APCs in the brigade would be off the road with broken quill shafts, and there were none coming through the supply chain. Now, I had 16 APCs off the road when I took over a unit in 1967, and I got in touch with Food Machinery Corporation in San Diego, and they directed me to the Cummins Diesel in Detroit, and Cummins Diesel in Detroit said, how many do you need? So we used our training aid funds, which were not very much, and we bought a whole bunch of these quill shafts, and they were sent over through the American logistics system, and we went down and picked them up. I got a big rocket from the logistics side, and I said, if this was an aircraft on the ground, you'd fly an engine over from Canada the next day, because an aircraft without an engine is useless. So an APC without a quill shaft is useless. This is an operational necessity. And the brigadier agreed with me and said, order some more. And so as a result, the Ordnance Corps suddenly had to go and get rid of the paperwork and go and buy the damn things. And from then on, we had no problem with keeping the APCs. We would be on the road with maintenance 3 to 5 weeks on exercise, various exercises all through the North German plains, and then on core exercises. And in our case, we went out with 97 APCs, and we came back with 96, and the other one had broken down about a mile out of camp. So, you know, we were maintaining these things, and all the units were doing this. Your maintenance levels were a point of pride to you. A vehicle down is a section of infantry off the road. So that's the way we looked at it. A gun that's broken down is sort of 12% of your firepower. So maintenance is extremely important, and people have that drilled into them. And they take, the drivers and the crew people take a great pride.
Mm-hmm. And having them on the road. And,
Can
you discuss the aging process of any of Canada's main weapons or machinery? For example, here's an example. How many hours of service were required for 1 hour of use for the Centurion versus the Leopard, or, you know, that sort of thing? Yeah. You don't have to give me.
Oh, the difference between the Leopard and the Centurion is whole crew plus all the mechanics that you can find to take care of a vehicle, as opposed to a small crew doing regular maintenance. Now, not to say that the Leopard didn't have the odd problem, but when it did, it could be fixed quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference, is that you'd have a whole tank off the road, and God knows when you can get back.
So if you had an exercise where you were using a Centurion for a day, you bring it back, how long is it in the shop?
Oh, God, just if it's on exercise and it goes back, you'll never see it again. Yeah, you won't see it until you finish the exercise a week, 10 days later. This seems strange, but the parts were difficult. The number of hours of specialized work that was necessary to keep this thing up, it's something like running your Sea King helicopters out here. You've got 30 hours of maintenance. It's a good vehicle, but 30 hours of maintenance for 1 hour of flying is just a little beyond your pocketbook.
Yeah. Okay, and the last question into this section is, where were your supplies, and this is a general question, but most of your supplies coming from, were they Britain, Germany, Canada, and how did you find that the speed of delivery was affected by where they were coming from?
Oh.
So I hear it with the quill shop, they were coming from the States.
Yeah, well, that was a specific piece of equipment, which I just happen to have some knowledge of where to get it, and that's because I just come down from the British forces, where I had been working with American colleagues, and I'd been in APCs then for almost 3 years, so I had a bit of more background knowledge on logistics and supply than many others, and I was able to put that to some fair use. American equipment coming up, once you got the authorization to have the stuff delivered, right off. British, on the whole, a little slower, but they were slow with their own people. Germans, we didn't exchange much except with the Leopard tanks. And as far as from Canada is concerned, it would come over in like bunches of grapes, you know, depending on when they could get a ship economically suitable to bring things over. So you'd have a glut for a few months, and then you would run out. Let's see. We changed over some equipment. For example, we got combat clothing. You wouldn't believe what we wore in the 50s. Black, yellow, orange coveralls with 1944 web equipment and boots that only your grandmother would wear.
Even during exercises?
Yeah, that's all we had. And as a result, when you'd see a unit of Canadians in the field, some would have grab hunting boots, some would have rubber-soled leather-top boots, because of the mud and the conditions. You don't tell a man to go out and if he wants to wear rubber boots, bless him. But we finally got all this new equipment, but it came in size ranges, which didn't cover everybody. And I had a 6'6" Newfoundlander who had 38-inch arms and 17-inch or size 17 boots, and there's nothing in the system to fit.
Poor guy.
And he couldn't get it from Canada because they hadn't made them. So they finally custom made him a whole set. He was put off with me because he liked his old coveralls. And his
he liked his orange coveralls?
Well, he had black ones, which are now were faded to gray. But he's
a newfie.
Yeah. Jesus, sir, you screwed her all up.
Oh, they're good for something, those newfies, hey? Okay, so let's move on to talk a little bit about Canada's role, specifically in the NATO force there. So the first question is, as a man on the ground, what role were you made to feel that Canada was playing in the defense of Europe? So there's the official line, and then there's what were you entrusted with personally? How did you feel that you were active in the participation in protection of Europe?
Go back one and say, what did the people in Canada feel? They couldn't care less. You're either an isolationist or you're an internationalist. And if you're in Europe in these periods, well, I just made a list of all the things which went in. Berlin blockade, 1949, same time the Korean War was developing. 53, the East German riots. 56, the Hungarian uprising and the Israeli Six-Day War. Those are connected. And I was in there with that. And we were operationally deployed with full ammunition and everything else to the border.
Really?
Oh, yeah. This is all part
to
of
the,
our...
To your line?
Yeah.
So 56, that would have been the Weiser stuff?
Yeah, that was the... Hungarian uprising.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We didn't know whether they were just going to continue on or not. And our thing was to cover the Fulda Gap. 58 was the U-2 spy plane thing. Then you have the Cuban Missile Crisis, 62. And all these things have got tentacles going all out. 67, 68, the Israeli-Arab War. And that... I happened to be involved in that because we had troops, I was with the British Army, and we had troops deployed in Libya doing field firing exercises and long range movement and things like that. It had taken almost a year to set up these exercises. And we got there out at RAF station El Adam outside Benghazi, and the war broke out. And orders came, surround the air base and hold tight. And I was prevented from going down there. I'd been doing the stuff from Central Germany. And they had a tight time because the Libyans were going to go along with the great big Arab thing. Of course, that was start with the pressure on oil, too.
Yeah.
And then 68 was the invasion of Czechoslovakia. And we deployed once again with absolutely everything we had, ammunition, and I even had, 55 reservists from Canada over for the summer. I said, sorry, gentlemen, as of now, we are deployed for real.
Wow.
And so we went out to our emergency deployment areas, the whole brigade, the divisions, and everything else, and Soviet military missions on our side, pick this up. So this is quickly transmitted back that there they've gone and they're fully loaded with ammunition, everything else. And the nuclear weapons places are offloaded and stuff, movements there, they don't know where they're going. But the Soviet military mission, send that home. So this is not going to be a pushover, is the word. Then there was the 72-73 Israeli Arab War, and this one here is extremely important to us because in that one the Israelis lost hundreds and hundreds of tanks because bad tactics, and the Egyptian anti-tank missiles destroyed them. They lost lots of airplanes. Airplanes are quickly replaced. Pilots aren't. The every M48 and M62 tank in war reserves in Europe, the American War Reserve in Europe, and in the States, were flown to Israel to make up losses. There we were sitting with no reserves in Europe, and there are no more reserves coming into the States. Now, you say, well, build some more. There's only one factory left, one foundry left in the United States making cast steel turrets, and that was in Virginia, I think. I think that's where it was. And they could only turn out 75 turrets a month.
A month.
So you can see how the power curve, and at that point we were extremely vulnerable because we couldn't take 2 days' losses.
So what years was this again specifically?
I'm sorry?
What year was this exactly?
That was in the 72-73 Israeli war.
Yeah.
The development of the Soviet Navy, pushing their Navy into the Mediterranean, pushing their Navy into the South China Sea, pushing their Navy down to Cuba and everything else. This is an expression saying, we are an international power. There are a tremendous number of incursions into our airspace by Bison, Bear, and other aircraft. Now, mind you, on the other side, there are lots of incursions into Soviet airfleet. Soviet submarine encounters, always, and the Sonus barrier was activated, the barrier that they have down the Atlantic coast. That was activated numbers of times, and it smacks of a search for Red October, you know, that sort of thing. Soviet intermediate range ballistic missiles, yep. ICBMs, their tactical nuclear weapons.
This is all building, all of this.
Oh, yeah, and this was going on just steadily until. I digress a bit. Until the Ronald Reagan, believe it or not, said we'll outspend them. And when you look at the arms expansion of the United States under Reagan and the expansion of the British forces and the French forces, all with new equipment, the Russians either had to come to terms or rebuild all their forces. Their navy was at the end where it had to be rebuilt. And there was a period there between 72 and about 75, which was the last window of opportunity they had to make a desperate effort to win. And after that, it was all diplomacy because the Soviets realized they couldn't keep up, and therefore it just gradually went. Mm-hmm. Because by outspending them, ruined the Soviet economy, ruined the East German economy, ruined the Bulgarian economy, all this sort of stuff. As a result, over 50% of their budget, I think you can check those figures, in the Warsaw Pact was geared to defense. Ours was something like 7-8%. So, you know, you start going through this. Some say, well, what a waste of money. It's not cheaper than one day of war.
Yeah.
And a lot less blood spilled.
Yeah.
So that's...
That's good. Good stuff. So with all of these mounting tensions, did... was the Canadian force made to feel that the Canadian presence in Germany was essential to the defense and stability of Europe?
Oh, yeah. When you're on 2 hours' notice to be out of camp, fully loaded, at any time, day or night, 7 days a week, for year after year, you're into a different thing than considering this as an academic problem and external affairs or in the cabinet world. When you're worried about daycare beds and stuff like that. We were very, very much operational and geared to it. This was a very tense, interesting period. And our troops, for the most part, the thinking soldiers knew why we were there. Not their other people, the only reason they were there was to follow orders and go off on leave. But you have that in universities, you have that in anything else. So, as far as I'm concerned, I was always quite aware of how close it was to breaking out at any time. I found it even more when I was on the Mutual Balance Force Reduction Conference. It was a very testy time, and intrigues all over the place. We had more East German spies in West Germany, Soviet military missions around, and you didn't dare. Every time you move, your movements were plotted. Now, mind you, I'm sure we did exactly the same on the other side. So
if we can talk a little bit specifically about what kind of action 4CMBG was prepared to take in response to Soviet, or the perception of aggression from the Soviets. So what was Canada's deployment areas? What were their responsibilities in the event of a conflict? Those sorts of things.
Well, we deployed as part of 1st British Corps. And that's 1st Division in the north, 2nd Division in the center, 4th Division in the south, and we were part of 2nd Division. The British 3rd Division would come over on reinforced alert, so they had a corps of four divisions plus a Canadian brigade, and they would have a Belgian division attached. We just went out and occupied our emergency deployment areas and waited for orders from that point. And our deployment area was just to the east of Hamel, Pied Piper Town. And there was a place called Schwerte, in the Schwerte Gap. Our brigade was on the east side of the Weser-Gebirge, facing out over the the plains which led off to Hanover and Braunschweig, and down to the our southeast was the Fulda Gap. So these were wide open, rolling farmlands. Had fought over many, many wars, but we were stretched out so paper thin. And that's exactly the time that Pierre Trudeau got 30%. And in fact, I just received orders from Brigadier Jimmy Gardner that my operational area was going to increase by about another 800 meters for a battalion. And that's a fantastic amount. And so I looked at it and he said, "Oh, by the way, you're losing a rifle company." We both sat and laughed. I said, this is just ludicrous.
And that was under Trudeau.
That was his presence in the fall of 1968.
Okay, so now we're going to talk a bit about the lines of defense. From 50 to 57, as you said, NATO's main line of defense in the central region was along the Rhine. And then in 57, it was moved to the Weser. Can you comment on why the line of defense was moved? You kind of did already. And then how it changed Canada's responsibilities or deployment areas.
The Rhine was a last ditch. And the Rhine would be defended with nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And the Germans, you see, when you move forward to the base or you increase your numbers, the Germans say, we don't want a nuclear war on our land. So therefore, you increase the number of German divisions, you increase, you start swinging the conventional warfare type of thing, and you move, you gradually creep forward. The Weser was the next logical place, though you could wade across the Weser in a dry summer. So, you know, it's a symbolic thing. And then you have to get your next line is the Weser-Gebirge, which is a big line of hills. And then beyond that, you're almost to the East German border in low ground. So to the south, there are lots of hills and forests and things like that. On the southwest of Paderborn. But on the whole, our deployment areas were on the Weser-Gebirge or in that area, and then we would branch out from there. Mm-hmm. Depending what the Corps commander ordered. And it could be, if an attack was coming here, you just might be told to go and get them from the flank, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So activities were dependent, obviously, on what was going on. Yeah. Was there ever a point, and you just mentioned this right now, at which 4CMBG came close to reacting to a Soviet crisis?
Oh.
All of those things you mentioned.
Yeah. Certainly, the Hungarian uprising, which was crushed, as we didn't know. We had no idea. And, of course, the other side weren't telling us. They were letting us stew because they wanted to keep us immobilized because their friends, the Egyptians, were in problems with the Israelis and the Israeli Arab War. So, you know, there's wheels within wheels on this. And certainly on the invasion of Czechoslovakia, which, while it didn't come as a total surprise, it was, because there are indications, you can't move troops around from Poland and Romania and Hungary and Bulgaria and East Germany without being picked up. I mean, satellites will pick up a fair bit. Plus, your intelligence service will tell you there's lots of movement going on. What you do with it is another thing. Mm-hmm. And we didn't think they would move in because international pressure at that time was leave them alone. But Brezhnev just couldn't do that because he was going to lose control, which eventually he did.
He did, yeah. Yeah. So what sort of, were there any exercises that were initiated during these periods of, you know, when conflict was thought to become open, you know, like what was the reaction for you at the Canadian base?
Oh.
This was in Lahr at that time, right?
No. I spent all my time in North Germany.
Okay. Yeah.
And we had large scale exercises every year, mm-hmm. right? They were called 443. I think was the number which gave us clearance to go cross country and all this farmland and everything else, pay for the damage, but we treated the whole of the country as a training area. Mm-hmm. And a whole area maybe 50 miles wide and 50 miles deep with towns, cities, villages, everything would be in that. And we literally treated it as an operational zone. Now, maneuvered all around there and did all the things, but we learned our trade without the restrictions of having to work on a small postage-sized training area in Britain or Canada or something like that. I digressed there, didn't I? No, we did a fair number of exercises, all operationally loaded, and almost ready. If at any time, and the opposition knew this, at any time we could change from training to operations. Because we were fit. Our vehicles were in shape, we had the equipment, and the one thing we didn't have, and this is something you didn't mention, what do you do with the dependents? In 56, we got a separate issue of trucks out of a British motor pool, and we repaired all these trucks, and we had decided ourselves to give all our vehicles, all our load-carrying vehicles, to the dependents to get them out of the area. But then, where are they going to go? How are they going to be evacuated? You send them along roads which are crammed with refugees, people doing the same thing, getting the hell out of there. Basically, you know, our dependents had had to have sort of 3 days' rations and water, and have their car all topped up with gasoline and extra gasoline, and then they would be supposedly taken by convoy. Supposedly, thank goodness, never tried. And while we went off into the nether, probably never to return.
So the women and children went one way, and you guys went the other way.
Yeah, that was the idea. And we would play for time until they can get...
And they were headed to the channel?
Yeah, they were headed to, at that point, we thought French ports on the channel, but who knows where they'd end up.
Just anywhere, but...
Yeah.
Wow. And did you have dependents over there at that time? Yeah.
Yep, I had a wife and one child, just a youngster, 55, he was 2 and 3, you know, two years old. Mm-hmm.
And they were. She was fully aware of what she had to do in the event.
She knew exactly what she had to do. Didn't like it, but there was no alternative.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, what sort of ideological background, if any, were you provided with in terms of Soviet communism?
Oh.
Was there any sort of education about this is the enemy, this is their political stance, this is why it's negative?
Yeah, it was available, but soldiers don't listen to that. They just think, oh, we've got more garbage, you know. Our soldiers in the 50s, had an average of a grade 8 education. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, it was about a grade 10. Now, you can't get into the infantry without a high school leaving certificate, you know. So, you know, you can just see the thing. So, they weren't terribly interested, just, you know, if that's the enemy, well, let's go kill them, you know, that sort of stuff.
Much more black and white.
Yeah. And don't bother me with details. And you'd have your little briefings with your platoons and your companies about the political situation, and you could just see, you know, just completely, if you want to put them to sleep quickly, bang. Now, there are a few people sitting, we would have very, very good discussions. But most people said, you know, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Let's not get too excited about this until it really happens, then I'll know what to do.
Yeah. To what extent did you feel valued and integrated within the German community?
That's, in Westphalia, it's much more difficult than it is down in Lahr.
Mm-hmm.
Westphalia, they say you have to eat a peck of salt before they'll acknowledge your presence. They're very dour.
Really?
But when you do make friends with them, they're friends for life.
Mm-hmm.
We had a family next door to us. The daughter came over one day and asked my wife if she could help her with her English. And she was speaking very good English, by the way. My wife sat down and saw her written work and suggested a few corrections, and because it's very stilted English, and so she smoothed up. And this young girl kept coming back and finding her mother came over, and then her father came over, and A little while later, bottles of cognac was here, you know, it was just an acceptance.
Yeah.
And different customs. They're very curious. The German is a very curious person.
Now, was that in Westphalia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, the only friends or the only people they made contact with were the people who came and worked for them. There's not that great entree into the community. For example, we had our own chapels, churches. Very few spoke German. A lot of people tried, but you have to speak the language fluently to be accepted. Those who did, quite accepted. I bumbled through on German. I've forgotten more than I remember. My wife was very good because she did a lot of shopping in German. Therefore, it was
part of her routine.
Yeah, part of her routine. And again, you go to the same shops all the time, and pretty soon they're addressing you by name, you know, and very good. And, you know, what is the special today? Oh, yeah, well, this is very good. You know, schmeckt gut. Yeah.
Your German's much better than mine. Now, you know the 70% rule, which, and I'm not even sure how this applies to 4CMBG, but was the 70% rule, whereby only 30% of a unit's strength could be on leave at any given time, in effect during your tours in Germany?
70%?
Yeah. So only 30% could be on leave.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So the 30% was the maximum strength of the army who could not be.
Oh yeah, your leave roster was put out almost on a yearly basis, so that you could plan your leaves, mm-hmm. and you knew that at a certain time you would be on leave, and someone would be covering your position. And so this was all integrated. Very, very seldom did you ever get a snap leave.
Snap leave, that would just refer to one surprise.
Yeah, just like, hey, this training area has closed down, mm. and we have this time. You now have a week. If you want to go on leave now, go. Mm.
Yeah. Very rare.
Yeah, very rare.
Okay, so both Trudeau's Defense Review of 69 and National Defense Minister Eric Nielsen's Review of 85 called for priorities closer to home and the limitation of Canada's NATO commitment to West Germany. Both reviews were met with anger on the part of various NATO capitals, and on both counts the Canadian government sort of stepped back and decided to remain, albeit with defense cuts, etc. Why do you think other NATO members, particularly Britain and Germany, were so set on retaining this Canadian force on the ground?
Because if you want to say it's symbolism, when one NATO partner says, okay, we don't see a threat anymore, we're up and out of here, what does that say to all the rest? And what does it say to the other side? Because we were still... Yeah, we still hadn't signed a treaty with the East to curb all the weaponry. Mm-hmm. We hadn't done our reductions. We were at the stage where we could. Personally, I felt betrayed by mm-hmm. Trudeau. I am seriously betrayed. I thought, we have committed our... our largesse, we've committed our youth, and this is our front line. This is not something for the Europeans. Now, contrary, if, for example, as you put to a European, if Canada was invaded by Soviets, would you send forces over here to help us? Oh, well, we... we'll have our own problems here. I said, yeah, well, this goes back back and forth. So there is an argument to say you have to take care of your home defense before you start committing to other defense. The other point of view, which I hold, is that geography dictates that we're not going to have that, and our front line is with where the threat is, which is Europe. So, again, you're either isolationist or nationalist, or you're an internationalist. And I think they were just... there was no one in the cabinet with any military background.
Just politicians.
Just politicians, and they had political pressures. Mm-hmm. And being politicians, who votes? Soldiers don't. I'm a little cynical on that. I just felt extremely betrayed. Mm-hmm. That we had worked all for 20 years to build the force up to it was a razor sharp, highly regarded force, regarded so by all the other allies. They're cutting edge weapon, really. If you want to put it back to the Canadian Corps in World War I, highly trained, highly disciplined, well equipped, knew what they're doing, and say, okay, we're going to take that whole lump out of there and get rid of it. Somebody's got to replace that.
And how did you notice things start falling apart after Trudeau came into power here?
Oh.
In terms of, you know, pulling men back home, defense budget.
Oh, defense budget, continuous decline, manpower cuts every year, equipment wasn't maintained, couldn't be maintained, ships at sea were tied up, aircraft were mothballed, and just gradually closed in. And this continued on until, 5-6 years ago. That, you know, people always talk, oh yes, let's get out there and build the defense. And we increase your budget 10%, but they took 12% away. You know, they give you the 10% for the public, but then they come in and they say, well, you can't spend that, you can't spend that, you can't spend that. So it adds up to more. And then with inflation, you're ending up with 12, 14, 15% decrease each year.
Which is enormous.
Which is enormous. As a result, we had equipment which didn't get serviced, didn't get spare parts for years. Aircraft which would have to be mothballed. And stop using the tanks. At one point, the Navy was not allowed to go above 15 knots because it would burn up too much fuel. Oh, you have to look into some of the details of the economy cuts that were made. Ammunition. Well, you really don't need them. You can use simulators. Okay, buy us a simulator. Oh, no money for that. You know, it was just a constant business of keep taking. And pretty soon we were down to, we went down to 9 infantry battalions at half strength.
Wow.
And artillery, my goodness, they just cut them right back. And tanks were grounded. The armored corps said, you don't need tanks. Who are you going to fight with tanks here in Canada?
And what was the maximum strength? You said it was cut down to 9.
Oh, well, say a battalion which was under the restricted thing would be anywhere around 500 men. Your maximum strength would be about 950.
And those were half strength. Yeah.
Plus nobody being recruited.
Right.
So your attrition rate as people go...
And it maybe affected reserves back home, too.
Yeah, reserves were cut as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just went completely crazy. Forward, I suppose, for sound political reasons, but it made no military or foreign service sense.
Yeah.
because we had no reputation. They were literally running on our reputation that was built for 30 years, and they kept on. But that watered down. And now people say, why do you want a seat at the table? You're not putting anything there.
So would you say that from, you know, early 50s up to late 60s, it was growing, you know, in support, supply, numbers, etc. Mm-hmm. And after that, with Trudeau, there was a decline?
Yeah, the provision of support was there till about 1968.
Yeah.
And from then on, when Trudeau made that business of cutting 30%, because this was he would have liked to have cut 100%.
Yeah.
I have a soapbox that comes to Pierre Trudeau, the great Canadian. I'm not a great fan.
Well, you're fully entitled to that opinion. I don't hold him in the highest regard either, but I won't say that around here because it's a very liberal institution.
This is, my goodness, this is huge. He wears a halo.
For some people.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that when it's turned off. Now, what else? Oh, yes, last one. At what point did the man on the ground realize the Cold War was no longer hot?
Never did.
Never did?
The Cold War was hot, and it remained hot until the Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah.
At any time, the Soviet ground forces of Germany could have been launched in desperation at that stage, but it could have been launched with their East German allies, who were also extremely vulnerable, as the Czechs were crumbling away, the Poles were having their problems. The only people who could make that thrust with a major force were the Soviet ground forces of Germany and the East Germans. Because the East Germans could see what was happening. The president there, Walter Ubert, recognized this, and he and Brezhnev were always having conversations on this. But the world was changing, and they didn't. They were trying to, shall we say, hold back the tide. And when the Czech Revolution took place with the Freedom of Prague and Lech Walesa and all this in Poland, the rot was in.
Yeah.
And of course, when Gorbachev came in, he was quite accepting of this, that we have to go back and rethink the whole thing. And Gorbachev was hated by the Russian military. And of course, when East Germany collapsed, that really started, opened up a whole can of worms. And Germany is still paying for it today. Billions and billions and billions of dollars have gone to try to stabilize the country. But don't forget, you have almost two generations of communist East Germans there. And so you've got to open it up.
Gradually, yeah.
The hot war never happened, but the cold war was there, with the spigot turning to hot at any time.
Yeah. Right up until Gorbachev kind of changed the flow and opened things up in the 90s.
Yeah.
Because I guess Canada came out, the last Canadians came out in 93, was it? 92?
Yeah, that'd be about it.
Yeah.
Sad, but somebody said you came up with honor. I wonder.
What would you say?
I'd say the soldiers came up with honor because they're very highly regarded. Canadian government looked on a bunch of pansies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so a little wrap up here. From the time you began with 4CMBG until the time you left, what were the most significant changes that stand out for you in terms of again, things you've been over, weapon supply, government funding, troop numbers, whatever you want to comment on.
I think the most significant thing is the change in the Canadian military from basically a British-founded and British-organized force with a World War II approach to the place where, after Korea, our training systems got down to deciding what is it we can do, how can we do it, and how much training. And train, train, train. And you learn to train on a postage stamp. You learn to train with nothing. And the professionalism of your officers had to be improved, and it was. Professionalism of your NCOs improved, and it certainly was. And your soldiers got better and better and better as you came through. The training systems are what are working to provide people for Afghanistan right now. The staff colleges, the Land Forces Command and Staff College, the National Defense Colleges, all these training our officers at a great rate. And all of the core schools, all the training methods are infinitely superior than they've ever been before. Mm-hmm. And this stands us in good stead. All it needs to do is just to... Matter of fact, they're training reservists in 6 months, out of a unit. 6 months with a unit, and they go off to Afghanistan. You can't tell one from the other.
Really?
Yeah. But if you look back, they have far more training than reinforcements going to Normandy in 1944. Mm-hmm. They were going over there with 6 and 8 weeks, and sometimes 2 and 3 months of training. These fellows are fully integrated into a unit for 6 months before they go, which is...
And the whole unit goes?
And the whole unit goes, yeah. Matter of fact, our 2nd Battalion is now just finishing its training, and they will deploy in January or February to Afghanistan. And they will be fully integrated with about 140 reservists. The unit, we don't have enough people. And if it wasn't for the reserves, there would be no units going to Afghanistan. Or you'd be going once.
Well, can you comment on any trends you noticed in terms of government support for Canada's NATO contingent? We talked about that. Trends kind of up before Trudeau and then after Trudeau hit the hay.
Yeah.
And then just in closing, can you comment on any changes in the perception of the Soviet threat over the years?
Since Gorbachev has been up and down, and now we're into another period with Putin where he is flexing his muscles because he has a military lobby who is looking to regain the prestige that they believe they once had. And so that itself is not nice, is dangerous, and is meddlesome. We try and put this down, but we provoke them also by Bush putting in, or the Americans putting in an intermediate range ballistic missile shield. And if I was a Russian, I would be a little interested in intermediate range ballistic missiles being put into the countries of my former allies. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine.
The trend is not as dangerous as it was, but God knows, it's just like throwing a match into a bonfire.
And Canada certainly doesn't have any sort of defensive mechanisms like that we once had.
Hmm. Say that one again.
Canada certainly doesn't have any defensive force or mechanisms like we had when you were participating with 4CMBG.
Now we're still, times are good here. You can't recruit.
Well, like you said, there's nobody but the reservists.
Yeah. And you tire your troops out with continuous deployments. Don't forget, some of these soldiers have done 3-4 tours in Cyprus, a couple in some other godforsaken place, and then they've some of them are on their third and fourth tour in Afghanistan. Eventually, the families say, enough's enough. And you lose your very, very best, highly trained, experienced people. But a lot of them come out and they join the reserves and they continue on there and sometimes even volunteer for another mission.
Good. Well, this has been just wonderful, Mr. Peacock. You've provided the project with some excellent information. Can I get a statement, an oral statement, just verbatim on the tape recorder for you to give us our consent to use your information in any projects and for the special collections?
You can use anything that we have talked about at any time in any way you see fit.
Wonderful. And you're okay with us quoting you by name?
Yeah.
That's okay. Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.